Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hello and welcome to another insightful episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast. I'm Thomas, your host and a partner at Strategy and. I hope you're doing well and are as excited as I am for today's conversation. We actually recently celebrated our 30th episode, and to mark the occasion, I asked my LinkedIn community for their input on potential guests and topics. So I'd really also love to hear from you about what you'd like to hear on the Strategy and Insider podcast ahead. So please feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn with your ideas and suggestions. Today's episode is actually particularly exciting as we explore a new area of healthcare we have yet to discuss. One of the top topics from my recent LinkedIn poll was neurocognitive disorders, and I'm really honored to have a leading expert in psychotherapy, psychiatry, and geriatrics with us today. So a special warm welcome to Professor Dr. Robert Panetsky. Robert serves as a professor of translational dementia research and heads the geriatric psychiatry department at the Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich. He also leads the Alzheimer Treatment and Research Center at the University Hospital Munich, where he focuses on healthy brain aging, dementia prevention, and interdisciplinary Alzheimer's therapy. A central theme in his research is the concept of cognitive reserve, which plays a crucial role in reducing dementia risk and enhancing resilience against neurodegeneration in vulnerable populations. Currently, Robert conducts dementia prevention research at both the University of Munich and the Imperial College of London. His studies apply a range of methodologies that includes imaging, fluid biomarkers, genomics, but also cognitive assessments in order to advance our understanding of the biological and the clinical processes that are underlying cognitive decline and related disabilities. Robert's academic journey also began at the Technical University of Munich, where he completed his medical studies and earned both his doctorate and habilitation. He also holds an MBA from the Warwick Business School in the UK. And since 2016, he is a member of the German Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases in Munich. As you can see, we're truly privileged to have you as a true expert with us today. So I'm looking very much forward to an insightful conversation about the understanding and treatment of neurodegenerative diseases.
Thomas, many thanks for the kind invitation. It's a true honor to be on your podcast.
Robert, it's truly an honor to have you join us today. So Robert, I'd like to start with a personal question on your daily job as a physician. Receiving a dementia diagnosis can be incredibly challenging for both patients and their families, as the disease's progression often involves adapting to a wide range of symptoms that vary from patient to patient, really. Many of us do obviously know someone affected by a neurocognitive disorder. And given these complexities that we're seeing, how do you personally navigate the emotional and professional challenges of working with seriously ill patients in your personal practice?
I think navigating the multitude of challenges relating to working with individuals with dementia requires a fairly versatile and adaptive approach. And we have to remember that forgetfulness is only the most prominent symptom of dementia, but things like agitated behavior and personality changes can be much more challenging to cope with, in particular for the patient's families. And I strongly believe that empathy and clear communication are skills that are very important for every physician, but they're in particular very important for physicians dealing with dementia patients. And these skills help to communicate with the families and help them understand the diagnosis and the key implications it has. And we always try to provide comprehensive support that goes way beyond the immediate medical needs. We have multidisciplinary teams that, of course, include physicians like myself, but also psychologists, neuropsychologists doing the cognitive tests, social workers supporting the families, occupational therapists, et cetera, et cetera. And since you asked a personal question, for me personally, maintaining a balance between compassionate care and let's call it professional detachment is essential to manage the emotional burden of working with seriously ill patients. But to be honest, I had started my career in surgery, and I must say that that I find working as a psychiatrist emotionally actually much easier because I have more time and more opportunity to spend talking to my patients. And this helps me to understand their needs much better.
And thanks for sharing that, Robert. And you mentioned a couple of elements such as empathy, such as comprehensive support through multidisciplinary teams that are engaged in providing that more comprehensive support to these type of patients. My sheer question also, knowing how clinical processes do work, is there enough time for this? Can you spend enough time with kind of taking care of the well-being of the patient and also associated family members?
Well, I mean, the honest answer is I work in a university clinic, and things are quite different compared to primary or secondary care, so kind of to your GP practice or the general neurologist practice. And I think we have enough time at the university level. We have the teams, mm-hmm. we have the support, we have the technology. It's much more challenging if you're a primary care physician sitting mm-hmm. in your practice. Then things become a lot more challenging, I think.
And as I was mentioning in my introduction, you also conduct dementia prevention research at the University of Munich and the Imperial College in London. How do the research approaches differ between those two countries and institutions? And additionally, are there any cultural differences in addressing neurocognitive diseases? And then kind of what can we learn from there?
Well, I guess in general, the research is actually quite similar in terms of the things that we try to address. But there are still significant differences in terms of the methodologies and the actual focus of the research. And some of these important differences can be explained just by the differences in the healthcare systems. So let's take the British National Healthcare Service, or NHS, that has a much more community-based approach to dementia care. And Germany, on the other hand, emphasizes institutional support. There are many more beds available in hospitals in Germany, for example. And this difference results in a much stronger focus on primary care in the UK. The general practitioner, GP, plays a central role in coordinating the patient care pathways. And what's actually quite nice in the UK is that primary care has a very strong tradition of excellent academic research. So the GP in the UK is a very strong partner in all of our research studies, which is actually very helpful. And another important difference, and something that we can learn from, is that population-based research, epidemiology, has a much longer and much stronger tradition in the UK. So it's easier to conduct large-scale, long-term observational and interventional studies, which is quite helpful in understanding, for example, the natural disease course of something like dementia. And as a final point, I also have the impression working in the UK is that altruism is a much stronger motivator of our participants to contribute to science. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also something that we can improve in Germany.
Okay. And I mean, you combine a lot because you're not only a physician, but also a researcher and someone who is holding an MBA from Warwick, as said before. How does this business education also influence potentially your approach to medical research, but also leadership within this field?
It was kind of a tough decision to do this MBA. That's something that I have to maybe start with. Not sure if I would do it again. Maybe I would. It was quite fulfilling, but uh-huh. it was stressful too, kind of in addition mm-hmm. to my work as a doctor. But I think I learned a lot about how I approach medical research in terms of coordinating studies, managing resources, leadership, organizational behavior, things like that I've never even considered or heard before my MBA studies. I think it has equipped me, at least with the theoretical skills, to effectively lead interdisciplinary, larger kind of global teams, mm-hmm. manage my research projects, and navigate some of the complexities of our healthcare systems. I also find it easier now to communicate in a way my research finding to mm-hmm. non-medical, non-specialist audiences and stakeholders, which I think is very important because these are fairly complex topics. And it's important that stakeholders such as politicians understand what we're doing. And I think it's also helpful in terms of communicating with our collaborators in the pharmaceutical and biotechnological industries, because if you speak their language, it's easier to convince them that the research that you are doing is actually beneficial for both parties. Mm. And that's how collaboration becomes more fruitful.
No, couldn't agree more that this is obviously something that does help you a lot, right, in terms of communicatable messages and understandable messages. So probably to officially introduce today's topic, it is important to clarify that dementia is not a single disease. It's instead a collective term for symptoms that result from various conditions such as Alzheimer's, which are caused by an abnormal change in the brain. And these conditions can impair cognitive abilities, affecting daily life, as you shared before, behaviors, emotions, and also relationships. Could you describe the biological processes that are involved in the development of different types of dementia in simple terms? And additionally, probably you can also let us a bit know how significant are genetic factors in these conditions that they actually occur?
Well, let me first maybe just repeat what you said, because it's so important. And it's a question that patients and families, but also our medical student ask quite a lot. So what's the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease? And it's important to understand that dementia is just a general term for loss of memory, language, problem solving, and other thinking abilities that is severe enough to interfere with your daily life. That's dementia.
Yeah.
And then dementia can have many different causes, including potentially reversible causes such as depression, for example. If depression is severe enough, it can cause a dementia-like syndrome. So not all dementias are caused by degenerative brain diseases. Some of them are reversible. But Alzheimer's disease, as the main neurodegenerative disorder, is the most frequent cause of dementia. So one is a disease. Alzheimer's disease is the disease which causes a syndrome called dementia. And that's important to differentiate. And these degenerative dementias involve a range of biological processes. They're quite heterogeneous. Most of them include some accumulation of abnormal proteins in the brain, and amyloid and tau are the two main proteins. In Alzheimer's disease, amyloid forms plaques, for example, and these amyloid plaques are kind of famous. That's what the pathologists see in the patient's brains. And then these protein deposits disrupt the communication between nerve cells that lead to the death of these nerve cells, and that's how symptoms emerge. So in Alzheimer's disease, as I mentioned, these proteins form plaques, amyloid plaques, and they form tangles built from tau protein. And genetic factors are important, but most sporadic forms of Alzheimer's disease, for example, are caused by many, many different genetic variants. APOE4 is the most important genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. And if a parent has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, the individual risk varies, but it is generally higher compared to the general population, in particular if there is a very clear family history of dementia. And there are very rare instances of familial dementia, which is caused by a genetic mutation. Mm-hmm. And in those very rare situations, your risk of developing dementia is much, much higher compared to the general population. But those cases are rare.
And still it is that we are seeing an unprecedented disease and health biology understanding on dementia and Alzheimer's in particular. So researchers around the globe are actively obviously investigating also therapeutic strategies to treat and at some point potentially even cure dementia. Despite significant progress in recent years, developing effective treatments and medications remains still somewhat of a challenge. In April 25, the European Medicines Agency finally actually granted marketing authorization for a novel Alzheimer's drug called lecanemab, which is designed to slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease in its early stages. This marks actually the first approval of its kind in the European Union. However, there is also some critique and critics arguing that the benefits of lecanemab may not sufficiently outweigh the associated risks. The German Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases, where you are a member, has also been a notable advocate for the drug's approval, emphasizing the urgent need for treatments that address the fundamental cause of Alzheimer's. Although the substance is not a cure, it has demonstrated potential in decelerating the advancements of Alzheimer's dementia when administered early. How overall do you assess the current landscape of Alzheimer's drugs therapies as such? And then also I will have also a follow-up question on how do you actually find these people early enough in the process? Is this really an easy job or rather a hard job to identify those patients? But probably starting with first the landscape on the Alzheimer's drug therapies as such.
Well, maybe first of all, the timing of this podcast couldn't be much better. And you may remember when you first asked me if I would be kind of interested in doing a podcast with you on Alzheimer's disease, we didn't know if lecanemab would be approved or rejected. And it was quite kind of a long journey. And we should maybe also mention donanemab, which is a very similar drug that has already been approved in the US and other countries, and which is currently undergoing kind of the authorization process by the European Medicines Agency. And these drugs target the amyloid protein that we just discussed, and they're disease modifying, whereas the previously approved drugs were only symptomatic. And that is quite an important difference. We have actually started to treat the disease and not just delay the symptoms. And that's a huge difference. So I think this is a breakthrough. It's not a cure, as you said, but it's a significant milestone, probably the biggest thing that has happened in my career so far. Something that we've kind of been working towards for years and decades. Clinical benefits of these anti-amyloid drugs are modest, but promising. But we also have to weigh these modest clinical benefits against the associated risks, such as brain swelling, which can occur. So a careful monitoring of these patients will be very, very important. And this is resource intensive. So that's why healthcare systems need to adopt and change. And I can already answer your second question here, because identifying individuals with very early Alzheimer's disease is a challenge. So those are situations where someone is a little bit forgetful. You can maybe barely measure this on one of your standard cognitive tests, and you need biomarkers. And these biomarkers currently are invasive. They require a lumbar puncture or some expensive piece of equipment, such as a brain scanner, a specialized brain scanner. Blood-based biomarkers are one of the important kind of breakthroughs that will make this a little bit easier, but it will still remain a big challenge. This general shift towards a more biologically focused diagnosis and therapy is very relevant, and it influences the landscape of Alzheimer's drug therapy development. And most of the drugs in the development pipeline target some kind of protein in the brain, amyloid or tau, or they target neuroinflammation, because Alzheimer's disease is not just a degenerative disorder. The brain also reacts to these protein deposits. They cause inflammation, and drug developers are trying to target the inflammation and modify it. But drug development is slow and inexpensive. And I think moving from today to the next generation of disease-modifying treatments will still take some time.
And I'm truly believing that the future of healthcare is going to be people-centric, not patient-centric anymore, and it will be much more preventative and also personalized. And we also argue that there will be an emerging life care ecosystem where there is still disease care happening, but also where there is another circle of well care where you are just a normal person and not sick. Listening to that, if it's difficult to find these early onsets of Alzheimer's patients, isn't it that also identifying those patients through behavioral markers, data markers in their very normal day-to-day life is going to be a goal going forward. So identifying how people are changing their behaviors when driving a car, when being at home, forgetting where they have stored some of their equipment, developments at work. Isn't this also something that we should be interested in?
Absolutely. I mean, these passive biomarkers that you mentioned are definitely the future. So something that you have in your shoe and that picks up changes in your movement because you're developing Parkinson's disease, or your the typing behavior on your mobile phone that picks up very early changes in your cognitive functioning. Definitely. I think currently the challenge in a situation where we have nothing that we can offer in terms of treatment or effective prevention is a little bit challenging. So I wouldn't do currently population-based screening for asymptomatic Alzheimer's disease because there is no drug. Kind of lifestyle interventions, potentially. I mean, that's something that you can offer. So maybe this motivates people to change their lifestyles, to live healthier lives. That could be one reason. But I would be a bit careful in the current situation where the drugs have not been tested in individuals with asymptomatic disease.
And probably briefly coming back to the situation that surrounds lecanemab and the fact that it has been actually over two decades since the last Alzheimer's drug that only was targeting symptoms was actually approved in Germany. So 2 decades. What keeps you motivated personally to continue your work in dementia prevention research despite, let's say, the often slow and arduous progress?
Well, I guess, first of all, brain diseases are fascinating and just kind of doing this more mechanistic, basic science-y research is just very exciting. Looking at brain networks and how they influence your behavior, how they change with disease, et cetera, et cetera. But that's kind of a very academic motivation. Mm. As a physician, I think I'm motivated by the fact that dementia has such a huge detrimental impact on our patients. And that's what I see in my day-to-day practice. That is motivation enough, I think, and the kind of the possibility or opportunity to improve the quality of life of these individuals and reduce the burden on them and their families definitely drives all of our commitment. And we're having promising breakthroughs now. So all these advancements that we just discussed in terms of treatments and biomarkers and personalized medicine and moving to this kind of precision prevention era of dementia management gives me hope and it's quite motivating. And I can also see how these research networks evolved on a global scale and working with people from different parts of the world, including Africa and Asia, where healthcare systems are very different, is exciting and important, I think. And I also think that generating real-world evidence is something that we definitely need to do. And there's not enough real world evidence in the Alzheimer's disease and dementia space. So we have to observe individuals on these new disease modifying treatments, see how effective and safe these treatments are in the real world outside of controlled clinical trials. And one thing that we have initiated recently is a global real world registry of Alzheimer's disease patients called INRAD, the International Registry of Alzheimer's Disease and Other Dementias, which will hopefully help us to start collecting practice-based, large-scale data that actually reflects what is going on in the population outside of trials.
And this is super fascinating that you're doing this because then, only then, right, also the real-life value can be measured that from any of the solutions, be it a drug or be it behavioral changes, are actually affecting positively patients' lives. So I will be curious to see what the outcomes will be in due course. As the global populations do obviously age, the incidence of dementia is expected to rise substantially, particularly in low and middle income countries. Currently, there is 55 million people that are affected by dementia, with new cases emerging every 3.2 seconds. I was really astonished when looking this up. The annual costs already today do exceed $1.3 trillion, and this is projected to reach even $2.8 trillion by 2030. So given all these statistics, how well equipped is the current healthcare system to really manage such a growing number of dementia patients to come?
Well, so the answer is easy. So first of all, healthcare systems globally are not well equipped to manage the growing number. So that's very clear. They're also not able to identify most dementia cases. And 50% of more advanced dementia cases are undiagnosed in Germany and any other countries, which is just a horrific situation, I think. So to improve these outcomes, policy reforms need to happen, and they need to focus on increasing funding for dementia research, I think. So cancer, for example, attracts a lot more funding, which is money well spent. That's quite clear. But dementia is a huge topic, very, very relevant. It will destroy healthcare systems because there's just not enough resources. We need to enhance and improve caregiver support. We have to develop comprehensive or more comprehensive care models to integrate medical, social, community services. We need to create a new system in Germany, for example, which is a lot more integrated and allows patients to get access to the care that they need in their current situation, which is not always medical. In more developing regions, well, the kind of critical basic infrastructure needs to be built first. And that also includes training programs for healthcare professionals to support dementia care. In many countries, there are no neurologists or no psychiatrists, no geriatricians. So the specialist expertise is just not available because of lacking resources also. And also collaboration between governments, healthcare professionals, nonprofit organizations has to be strengthened on a global scale because this is a global problem. Mm-hmm. And I want to highlight the national dementia plans because their role is so important. And it's also a WHO kind of key performance indicator that most countries should have a national dementia plan in place. And the existing German plan, for example, is pretty good already, but it definitely needs a stronger emphasis on prevention, early diagnosis, and the memory clinics, specialized memory clinics, for example, in Germany are well equipped to provide these services, and they need to be integrated more into this planning process. And another resource that we have established for Germany is the Deutsches Netzwerk Gedächtnisambulanz and German Network Memory Clinics, which is kind of our club of memory clinics with the main aim to harmonize our work, to establish standards, to make sure that for the new treatments, for example, there are guidelines which people can follow so that quality of care is top notch.
You mentioned something, Robert, that sparked my interest. You talked about the collaboration that also needs to be strengthened globally, because I'm also convinced that increasingly we will see a convergence of industries and industry players. When we take Alzheimer's, for example, if we want to really have passive markers, identifying patients early enough, probably even nudging patients to even prolong and delay the onset of the diseases and further symptoms, and then generate personalized solutions that are really fit for purpose for the patient, him or herself. This merits really a collaboration that goes beyond traditional pharma and diagnostics and hospital and whatsoever players, also tech teaming with companies that develop, I don't know, smart t-shirts from the apparel industry, smart cars that measure your behavior over time and how you steer a car, how you react and how this deteriorates over time. And we could go on and find further examples. How do you see this? Isn't this also going to be the future if you really want to manage dementia in a comprehensive way?
Absolutely. I mean, dementia is a chronic, progressive, or most dementias are chronic, progressive disorders. They are not only medical issues, there are social challenges. So they will not be solved by the pharmaceutical industry and physicians and hospitals, but they need the global society needs to adopt to kind of address these needs. And the things that you mentioned are excellent examples, how certain kind of select problems of someone who suffers from dementia could be solved. Absolutely. Yeah.
In a recent conversation with Professor Dr. Jochen Werner from the University of Essen, and who is kind of managing the hospital there, he mentioned that artificial intelligence will transform literally every aspect of healthcare. And given the rapid advancements and the growing integration of innovative technologies in healthcare, how do you see the role of tools that are digital, that are AI, and also telemedicine in promoting healthy aging and also potentially advancing the research on neurodegenerative diseases?
Well, like in most other fields, I think these digital technologies, AI-driven approaches absolutely have a massive potential in revolutionizing dementia research and care, personalizing treatment, improving monitoring, et cetera, et cetera. And in any situation in medicine where you have huge amounts of data, AI is particularly useful. So we use it for to develop better brain imaging analysis technologies. That's a lot of data where AI is just excellent. And telemedicine can make medicine and medical services more accessible for patients in remote areas, for example. So it's nice to live in Munich, for example, where I live and where I practice. You have everything that you need, but if you are a little bit more remote area of Germany, telemedicine could actually be very helpful and appropriate in many situations. In terms of research, I think these digital tools can help us to do more meaningful, large-scale, longer-term studies because they help us to save resources, help us to identify more patients, provide them with access to cognitive testing, for example, which is web-based. Those are examples where we use digital technologies for our research. And this all together will ultimately promote healthy aging and then definitely advance our understanding of degenerative brain conditions. And together with a colleague of mine, just to give another example, we have actually founded a startup company called MeadowTrax about a year ago to develop AI-driven cognitive and other diagnostic assessments with the aim to aid physicians in making better and earlier dementia diagnoses. And there are other companies doing similar things. So there is actually quite a lot going on this field. And there's also a few large-scale European, funded by the EU Commission, projects which aim to establish platforms for early diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. So there will be websites where you can do your cognitive testing, whole home-based biomarker kits where just a drop of blood is enough to measure your biomarkers. Predictome and AD Riddler are two examples of projects where we're involved. So there's a lot going on in this field, actually.
So it's a very vibrant one that's clearly visible. And probably also a question, I know we touched upon that earlier, that Alzheimer's, but also other forms of dementia, not only impact the one who is diagnosed, but also the loved ones around the patient, him or herself, often resulting in feelings of grief, anger, probably even guilt as they cope with the loss of the person they knew and the evolving dynamics of their bilateral relationship. So considering the emotional and psychological challenges that are faced both by the patient and their families, how does your research or also clinical realities focus on improving the quality of life for those individuals living with dementia, actively or passively?
Well, my own research is quite biological. And I think how all of what I'm doing influences and improves quality of life is that by diagnosing Alzheimer's disease and other dementias earlier, we empower those individuals to change their lifestyles, to get access to better treatment and to prevent worsening of the disease, which is massively important for quality of life. Support systems for caregivers are crucial, I think, and should include access to counseling, services, respite care. We need better educational resources. We have to create community networks and support groups, which already exist in large cities, but which are relatively difficult to access if you're not in one of the large cities. Local memory clinics are very good resources. And I also want to mention the Alzheimer's associations, which at least in larger cities exist and which are very helpful and can provide access to local kind of support services or information that, that someone with dementia and their family needs. And remote counseling, that we already touched on digital technologies, I think is the future to make healthcare more equitable and accessible, even outside of kind of large city hubs.
So bottom line, our brain is obviously the central hub kind of for everything we do, be it movement or perception, thinking, learning. Your colleague, Professor Dr. Gerd Kempermann from the German Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases in Dresden recently emphasized the importance of physical and mental exercise for brain health. How can lifestyle factors such as diet, exercises, social interactions influence actually the prevention, and if not possible to prevent, at least the progression of Alzheimer's and potentially other dementias? Probably you can give us, and also the listeners, some practical experience from routines on how we can keep our brain active and healthy.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned this topic, because lifestyle factors, they are very important when it comes to preventing dementia and its progression. And there's a very prominent series of publications by the Lancet Journal, which is one of the most important scientific journals globally. And they asked a panel of experts to screen the evidence for potentially modified risk factors for dementia. And they just published second update from this original publication a few years ago. And they came up with a list of 14 factors that are potentially modifiable, and most of which are related to our lifestyle choices. And when you took all of these factors together, they explain about almost half of dementia risk in the population, which is pretty significant.
Wow.
This also means that the other half is not explained by these lifestyle factors, but by genes, gene lifestyle interactions, et cetera, et cetera. But this is quite a significant finding. And then, for example, as you mentioned, a balanced, let's say Mediterranean style diet is helpful in preventing dementia. Regular physical exercise is very important. Being cognitively, socially active can enhance brain health and reduce risk of cognitive decline. Managing your depression, if you suffer from depression, is very important. Interestingly, hearing loss in midlife is an important risk factor. We are still working on the explanation, but probably the easiest explanation is you need to hear to work on a podcast, for example, and need the podcast to stimulate your brain, and that increases your brain reserve and hence reduces your dementia risk. So social interaction is very important. So living healthy lives is helpful. So specific practices to keep the brain active include, well, things like learning a language, some new activity, something that is engaging, fun, social. Just doing crossword puzzles, it's not going to be enough. So it has to be more complex and interesting and motivating. Managing stress levels is good. Healthy sleep is very important. And then all of these kind of lifestyle habits and choices taken together improve resilience of your brain and may help to prevent degenerative diseases and dementia.
Well, thanks for sharing this. And what becomes very apparent to me is that dementia obviously is a very complex field that is manifold in terms of reasoning behind. But the good thing is there is a lot of elements that we can manipulate and steer ourselves. So we can prevent if we know how to. If I can just ask you, because it's rarely happening that obviously I can talk to an expert like yourself around dementia and Alzheimer's. If you would be kind of to have this podcast in 5 to 7 years from now with me again, what will be the biggest leaps you think we will have seen in that period, 5 to 7 years, in a sense of prevention, identifying patients, treating patients with dementia?
Probably AI will play a much larger role. We will have better ways to identify cognitive decline earlier. We will probably have better biomarkers. You may not need advanced imaging to diagnose Alzheimer's disease, but some less invasive biomarker. And hopefully we will have good real-world evidence from the current first generation of disease-modifying treatments, providing evidence that they're actually safe and effective. That's something that I would expect. Mm-hmm. And then maybe we'll already have the second generation of disease-modifying treatments on the market, targeting different disease mechanisms compared to the current first generation. I think these are the expectations that I would have in this 5-year window.
Great. Hey, big and true thank you, Robert, for this very insightful conversation and for sharing your really very valuable expertise on neurocognitive disorders, the current state of research, but also its manifold impact on our society and the healthcare system. And thank you, everybody, for listening today. I really hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as I did. And please leave us a positive review under your favorite podcast platform. Until next time, and take care.
Strategy made real.